Well, why should there be obstacles in the work of God anyway? Because, of course, the devil is active and he opposes the work of God in any way that he can. And tonight, we are going to look at some of the stratagems of the devil. Paul said, we are not ignorant of his devices. Well, I think after our study this evening, we will be able to agree with the Apostle Paul that we are not ignorant of many of the devices of the devil, because there are eight of them that are listed in chapters 4, 5, and 6. We have quite an assignment to cover these three chapters this evening, but I wanted to take them as a unit. So if you'll follow with me carefully in your Bibles, we'll try not to go too fast as we look at these eight threats to the construction of the walls of the city of Jerusalem, eight obstacles to the completion of God's work. First method of opposition then was by ridiculing the Jews in 4:1-6. In each case, I want to point out both the problem and the remedy. The problem is readily seen. But it came to pass. But it came to pass. And I think that the conjunction follows upon chapter 3, where all of the building activity of the wall is rehearsed, and we traced that last week with all of the busyness and all of the progress that was being made. Still, there was opposition. But it came to pass that when Sanballat, he was the governor of Samaria, heard that we builded the wall, he was wroth, took great indignation, and mocked the Jews. He called apparently the armies of Samaria together in the hearing of the Jews, and this is how he mocked them. He spake before his brethren and the army of Samaria, and he said, what do these feeble Jews? Notice, he asks a whole series of sarcastic questions. What do these feeble Jews? Will they fortify themselves? Will they sacrifice? Will they make an end of the day? Will they revive the stones out of the heaps of the rubbish which are burned? You can hear the sneer in his voice, the mockery that he indulges in as he ridicules the Jews. And I think in response, probably the army and the others of Samaria laughed in derision. Then Tobiah takes up the jest, the Ammonite, and he said, even that which they build, if a fox go up, he shall even break down their stone wall. Belittling the work of God, saying that the construction work that was being carried on was very flimsy at best and not really a threat to anyone. This is a trick of Satan. I read somewhere that when the first American steamboat took 32 hours to go from New York to Albany, that the people laughed. That the horse and buggy passed the early motor cars as if they were standing still. Often they were. And people laughed. Some of you will remember some of these things. They're a little bit beyond my time. The first electric light bulb was so dim, people had to use a gas lamp to see if it was lighted. People laughed. The first airplane came down 59 seconds after it left the ground, and people laughed. Mockery, derision, sneering. Of course, sometimes this mockery is directed at believers. I don't know whether the liberals still carry this on to the extent that they used to, because their numbers are actually reducing while the numbers of the Bible believers are increasing. However, I think the liberals are sort of like the poor. Jesus said, the poor you will always have with you. And I think that the liberals are probably in that category. Recently, in Christianity Today, there was in one of the columns by Dr. Addison Leach this statement. Two seminary students told me recently that they were instructed in certain classes not to use the Bible as the support for the positions they took. They assured me that when one man in the class argued from Scripture, he was laughed to scorn. I do not even need to say that that seminary was not located in Dallas. But there are some where Bible-believing students are laughed to scorn. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was a German clergyman before he was executed by Adolf Hitler, paid a visit to this country. He commented on American theological education, and he said this, quote, "A theology is not to be found here. They chatter till all is blue without any factual foundation or any criteria of thought becoming visible. They intoxicate themselves with liberal and humanistic expressions, laugh at the fundamentalists, and basically they are not even a match for them." And Bonhoeffer was not a fundamentalist. "Often it goes through and through me when here in a lecture they dismiss Christ and laugh outright when a word of Luther's is quoted on the forgiveness of sin." So as the enemies of the people of God mocked and laughed in scorn and derision at what the people of God were doing in Jerusalem, there are still those who thus minimize what the children of God are doing. What is the remedy? That was the problem. The remedy in verses 4 to 6. In the midst of the raucous laughter of the enemy, there is a quiet voice lifted in prayer. And this is Nehemiah. This is one of the 8 brief prayers of the book. You might sometime want to read the book and check those 8 prayers. "Hear, O our God, for we are despised, and turn their reproach upon their own head, and give them for a prey in the land of captivity, and cover not their iniquity, and let not their sin be blotted out from before thee, because they have provoked thee to anger before the builders." Seems like a harsh prayer, like some of those in the Psalms, but Nehemiah says, "Lord, these people are not only the enemies of the Jews, they are the enemies of God. And I am praying that your cause may succeed." And so he prays that God will judge them. "So built we the wall, and all the wall was joined together unto half the height thereof, for the people had a mind to work." The little word "so" occurs 20 times in the book of Nehemiah. And it is a characteristic word of the book. It is a little action word. And, for example, in verse 21, "So we labored in the work." And finally in chapter 6, verse 15, "So the wall was finished. So we did this. So we did that." They moved right along in spite of the opposition to the work of God. And here the reason is given basically because the people had a mind to work. Led by the inspiring example and leadership qualities of a man like Nehemiah, the people, as we saw last week, overcame their inertia and got busy and in spite of the opposition, continued in the work of the Lord. All right, the second method of opposition was by threatened attack. Verse 7, "But it came to pass that when Sanballat and Tobiah and the Arabians and the Ammonites and the Ashdodites," all of this grouping of enemies, "heard that the walls of Jerusalem were made up and the breaches began to be stopped, then they were very wroth and conspired all of them together to come and fight against Jerusalem and hinder it." They saw this as a very real threat to their security in the land. They did not want to see Jerusalem prosper. They did not want to see it become a stable and secure city. And so they were alarmed at what happened, and they conspired to come in an open attack against the city of Jerusalem. That's the problem. The remedy? Verse 9. "Nevertheless, we made our prayer unto our God and set a watch against them day and night because of them." This is a very instructive verse. I'm reminded of the story of D.L. Moody and a friend of his. The two preachers were crossing the Atlantic, and a fire broke out in the hold of the vessel. And a bucket brigade was formed, and the water was being passed down the line. I don't know whether they were getting it out of the swimming pool or where it was coming from, but they were passing it down the line into the hold, and there they were trying to put the fire out on the ship. Well, Moody's preacher friend said, "Moody, I think we better go to our stateroom and pray." And Moody said, "No, sir, my friend, you pray while you pass the buckets." Well, that's the example here of Nehemiah. He didn't say, in face of the intelligence information he had received, that there was an open attack being threatened. He didn't say, "Well, everybody stop their work, we're going to have a prayer meeting." He did say, "Nevertheless, we made our prayer unto our God and set a watch." Did both. Like the little boy that I read of the other day, he and his little sister enjoyed looking out their window over the meadow and watching the rabbits. And one day they were shocked to see a man setting traps for the rabbits. And they were very disturbed about this. The next morning, the little boy said to his sister, "I prayed last night that the rabbits wouldn't get caught." The little sister said, "Well, I did too, and God told me to go out and spring all the traps." So she prayed and she put feet to her prayers. Sometimes we do need to do both. Sometimes, certainly, always we need to pray. But often there is the human responsibility that accompanies it. It's not just simply to pray. We are also to exercise our God-given abilities. Not that alone without prayer, but pray and watch. Watch and pray. To only pray would be presumption. Only to watch would be lack of faith. And so it's the combination. In an academic situation, if a student says, "Well, I've got an exam tomorrow, I'm going to pray about it." Good. But he better do something else. He better pray and study. Not pray alone, not study alone, but pray and study. And this is the example that Nehemiah sets before us here. "Nevertheless, we made our prayer and set a watch against them day and night because of them." So, they've overcome two methods of opposition. The third, in verses 10 to 23, by discouragement. Oh, is this a familiar tool of the devil? I think you may remember the story. I think I've told it here before, the legend about all of the tools of the devil that were labeled and placed on display for sale. And one was over in a corner. It was well-worn. It was very highly priced. And it was never sold. Someone went to the devil and said, "Why is that priced so highly?" He said, "Well, most people don't realize that that's one of my tools, but I found that it's most effective. When all of the others fail, I can use that one, and that's the tool of discouragement." And let me tell you that in the work of God, the tool of discouragement is one that the devil likes to use. Now here they are in the progress of the work. The work is half done. According to verse 6, the wall was built to half the height thereof. And that initial spurt of enthusiasm that you see had been overcome. Now the work was half done, but they couldn't quite see the end. And so they were discouraged. Notice the problem. Judah said, "The strength of the bearers of burdens is decayed. People are getting tired. There is much rubbish." Not any more rubbish than there had been at the beginning, probably less. But there was the rubbish. "We're not able to build the wall. And our adversaries said, they shall not know, neither see, till we come in amongst them and slay them and cause the work to cease." They were spreading rumors that the enemy was going to attack suddenly and without warning. And the people were nervous about that, understandably. "Came to pass that when the Jews which dwelt by them came, they said unto us 10 times, From all places whence you shall return unto us, they will be upon you. They'll spring out from behind the tree and from out the bush and from behind the pile of rubbish. The enemy will spring at you, and you won't even know in advance they're coming. And the people are discouraged. What does Nehemiah do? What is the remedy? Well, in the rest of the chapter, he sets into motion seven things. I think Nehemiah sensed that this was a desperate situation. He knew that the tool of discouragement could bring the work to a close. And so he adopts very quickly sufficient measures to overcome the discouragement of the people. Notice what he does. You might want to mark them in the margin of your Bible. First, verse 13. Therefore set I in the lower places behind the wall, and on the higher places I even set the people after their families with their swords, their spears, and their bows. So he armed families where they were working and positioned them in places behind the wall. Then verse 14, in the second place, I looked and rose up and said unto the nobles and the rulers and the rest of the people, be not afraid of them. Did he see the enemy coming? He looked and rose up. Maybe he was standing on top of the wall and looking over there, and he saw some of these Arabians and Ammonites and Ashdodites coming, led by Sanballat and Tobiah. And he shouted down to the people who were working there, don't be afraid of them. They're coming, but don't be afraid of them. Remember the Lord. So that's the second thing that he did. He gave them a battle cry. Remember the Alamo, remember the Maine, remember Pearl Harbor. Great battle cries of history. But here's the best. Remember the Lord. If God be for us, who can be against us? Who is great and awesome, and he will fight for your brethren and your sons, and you fight for your brethren, your sons, your daughters, your wives, and your houses. It came to pass when our enemies heard that it was known unto us, and God had brought their counsel to naught, that we returned all of us to the wall, every one unto his work. I think when somehow the enemy learned that the people were rallying in faith in God and rallying to their work, they turned back, and it seemed like that crisis was overcome. Third thing that he did, verse 16, he took half of his servants who labored in the work, and the other half of them held the spears, the shields, the bows, the habergeons, that is, the coats of mail, and the rulers were behind all the house of Judah. So he took all of his servants and armed half of them, and the other half worked behind the wall. Fourth thing that he did, they which builded on the wall, and they that bear burdens with those that laid it, every one with one of his hands wrought on the work, and with the other hand held a weapon, a sword in one hand and a trowel in the other. Charles Haddon Spurgeon, the great Baptist preacher of the last century, put out a weekly paper which he captioned The Sword and the Trowel. And this is where he got it. And Nehemiah said, look, we can't quit building and give all of our time and attention to defending, to defense. We can't do that. On the other hand, neither can we ignore the fact that the enemy is out there and just keep on blithely building as if there is no opposition. So we will do both. We will defend ourselves against the enemy, and we will continue our building. And thus, I think he sets a very noble example for the work of God. I have known some men in the ministry who have ceased building in the work of God and who have devoted all of their time and attention and energies to the work of defense. And they're always out smoking out heresy somewhere and out there on the front lines defending the work. Well, we're called on to defend the faith. But I think it's a good thing to have a sword in one hand and a trowel in the other, and to build something for God while we are defending the work of God. This is what Nehemiah armed his people to do. The fifth thing that he did in verse 5 and verse 19 and 20, he prepared a signal. He said to the nobles, rulers, and people, the work is great and large, and we are separated upon the wall, one far from another. In what place, therefore, ye hear the sound of the trumpet, resort thither unto us, our God shall fight for us. So, if there is a blast of the trumpet, everyone converge on that point, because that is the place where the attack is coming. That was a very wise move. Sixth thing that he did was to ask the people to work extremely long hours. So we labored in the work. Half of them held the spears from the rising of the morning till the stars appeared. And then finally, he asked everyone who was coming into the city to work to remain within the city, thus to give them a larger defense corps for the city itself. Let everyone with his servant lodge within Jerusalem, that in the night they may be a guard to us and labor on the day. So neither I nor my brethren nor my servants nor the men of the guard which followed me, none of us put off our clothes, saving that everyone put them off for washing. Glad he put that in, but really, we're not quite sure that's what the text says. The text is obscure, and probably a better reason is that everyone went with his weapon to the water. That is, even when he went for refreshment or to wash his clothes, he carried his weapon with him. All right, so the first three threats to the construction of the work are overcome. And in this chapter, I look upon Nehemiah. I see that he's a man of prayer. For I read in verse 4, "Hear, O our God, for we are despised." He is a man who prayed easily in hours of crisis. But when a man prays in an hour of crisis so well, we know that he's also praying. He's on a daily footing and has fellowship with God. He's a man of prayer. He was a man of faith. Verse 20, "Our God will fight for us." He was a man of practical wisdom. He set in motion so many methods, systems of civil defense for the people, that he showed himself to be a man of great practical wisdom and common sense. Now in chapter 4, we have the fourth threat to the construction, the fourth obstacle to God's work, and that is by internal strife. Interesting that the entire chapter is given over to this problem, because it too is a serious one. In fact, I think the enemy heard about it, and they are not even mentioned in the chapter. Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem the Arabian, and the Ammonites and the Ashdodites, they are not mentioned, because they realized that the Lord's people were weak when they were divided. And so they sat back, hoping that the division would rupture into an open confrontation and that the work would cease. Someone has said that in a church quarrel, the devil stays neutral and supplies ammunition to both sides. And I believe that. Because the devil is the cause of division. The spirit unites, and the devil divides. And he is active here. He's created a situation among the people of God so that there is animosity. And division is threatened. What is the problem? Verses 1 to 5, and then the remedy, verses 6 to 19. "There was a great cry of the people and of their wives against their brethren the Jews." I think that the cry was a cry of the poor against the rich. In order to get food for their families, in order to pay the high taxes that the Persian government had levied upon them, the poorer people had to mortgage their lands and even their children as servants. And they couldn't redeem their lands, they couldn't even redeem their children, And this was something that was being done within the family of Israel. So, the great cry of the people and of their wives was of these poor folk who were losing their lands and even their children. The poor were getting poorer and the rich were getting richer. For there were that said, we our sons and daughters are many, and therefore we seek grain for them that we may eat and live. Some also there were that said, we have mortgaged our lands, vineyards, houses, that we might buy grain because of the dearth and the famine. There were also that said, we have borrowed money for the king's tax, and that upon our lands and vineyards. Yet now our flesh is as the flesh of our brethren, our children as their children. We bring into bondage our sons and daughters to be servants. And neither is it in our power to redeem them. Well, of course, this was contrary to the law. Deuteronomy 15, 7 through 11 makes clear that this situation was intolerable and contrary to God's Torah, God's law. What is the remedy? Well, Nehemiah senses that he has got to deal decisively with this problem. And so he says, we read verse 6, "And I was very angry when I heard their cry and these words." That is probably a great understatement. "Then I consulted with myself." I think that means he counted to 10. "And I rebuked the nobles and the rulers, and I said to them, ye commit usury, every one of you against his brother. And I set a great assembly against them." In Leviticus chapter 25, verses 36 and 7, this is condemned. In Deuteronomy 23, verses 19 and 20, this is condemned. When the poor had needs, they were to freely give to them. If they loaned something to the poor, some money, they were not to charge interest of any kind unless the poor was a stranger. And then they could charge a modest interest of them, but not of Jews. The Jew should not charge interest if he loaned money to a poor Jew, contrary to the law. Nehemiah called a public assembly because it was a public scandal and it is going to be aired publicly. This is a principle of operation, I think, all through the Scriptures. When among the people of God there is a public scandal, it should be dealt with in a public fashion. It should be aired publicly and dealt with publicly. But when there is a private matter, a matter between two brethren, it should not be aired publicly. It should be dealt with privately. But this is a public scandal, and therefore Nehemiah set a great assembly against them. And he has 3 points that he calls to their attention. First of all, he sets himself up as an example. We, speaking editorially, we, after our ability, have redeemed our brethren, the Jews, which were sold to the heathen or the nations. That is, back in Persia, some of the Jews had fallen into slavery in their poverty. And Nehemiah said, you know, I bought them back out of my own funds. And will you sell your brothers? I bought and you're selling. Then held they their peace and found nothing to answer. Then he gives an explanation in verse 9. "Also I said, it's not good that you do. Ought you not to walk in the fear of our God because of the reproach of the heathen, our enemies?" Paul said in Colossians 4, 5, "Walk in wisdom toward them that are without." Nehemiah says, how does this division among us appear to our enemies? And that should always be a matter of concern. Just recently, I was through 2 Samuel, teaching 2 Samuel, and course, that book has so many lessons, but it is a great lesson, a great warning against the peril of falling into sin on the part of the child of God. And Nathan said, after David had sobbed out Psalm 51, in which he threw himself on the mercy of God, he should have died, should have been stoned to death. That's what the law said. He cast himself on the mercy of God, and God made an exception of grace and forgave him. But Nathan the prophet said, by this action you've caused the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme. And they still are. Hollywood makes a movie out of it. They still play it on television. And the world laughs. The man after God's own heart, and look what he did. And the world laughs. The child of God needs to have a concern. We need to walk in wisdom toward them that are without. And that is exactly what Nehemiah is saying here. Ought ye not to walk in the fear of our God because of the reproach of the heathen, our enemies? Then he exhorts them. I likewise and my brethren, verse 10, and my servants, are lending money and grain. I pray you, let us leave off this usury and restore unto them this day their lands, their vineyards, their olive yards, their houses, and 100th part of the money and of the grain, the wine, the oil that you exact of them. So he solemnly and publicly rebukes them. He talks about his own example. And he said, now let's make it right. And they agree to do so. Verse 12, we will restore them. We'll require nothing of them. And the last part of verse 13, and the people did according to this promise. Then in the rest of the chapter, Nehemiah, in a little soliloquy or monologue, talks about himself again. I don't think that he was an egotist at all. I think he is merely demonstrating for the record that he, as a leader, was in a position to deal with this sin on the part of the people because he was a man of integrity. You know, there is nothing so repulsive as someone getting up rebuking someone else when he himself is guilty of the same or worse sins. But Nehemiah is demonstrating here that he was living not a perfect life, but an exemplary life. He was a man of integrity, and because of that, he was in a position to deal with the sins of others. And so he tells us here that for the 12 years that he was governor, he didn't even take a salary. You say, well, he must have been a well-to-do man. I think he was, but that's not the point. He could have enriched himself further, but he refused to do that. For the 12 years that he was governor, he said, I have not eaten the bread of the governor. That is, I have not taken the salary that was properly mine. Secondly, verse 16, he says, I didn't engage in land speculation. And of course, he had an opportunity to do that. He could have bought up some of the land that the poor people were selling, but he didn't do this to enrich himself. Furthermore, he fed 150 people at his table. And then he says, verse 19, think upon me, my God, for good, according to all that I have done for this people. Lord, the people are not going to long remember me. I pray that you will. Some have raised question about this prayer, but I don't see any problem with it at all. Nehemiah is laboring with eternity's values in view. He knows that the people won't thank him. They will not long remember him. He's not deeply concerned about that. What he is concerned about is that God will take note of the fact that he is laboring for his approval. He wants to hear when he gets in the presence of God, well done, thou good and faithful servant. And you can believe me, he did. Now, in this chapter then, I see Nehemiah demonstrating a number of things. Number one, he had a capacity for moral indignation. a capacity for moral indignation. He was morally indignant what was happening among his people. We have some political candidates for high office who are, rather than showing moral indignation, they're trying to identify themselves with the people. And that's not we want what we want in our leaders. We want them to be moral examples. And this is what Nehemiah was. He was a moral example. And he showed a capacity for moral indignation. Not many in this nation who have that capacity anymore. We're losing it as a people. And someone has said, when the capacity for moral indignation goes out of a nation, it's finished. There are still some in our country who have a capacity for moral indignation. And this is what we need. Not only among our people, we need it on the part of our leaders. Not a desire to demonstrate that they're like everybody else. We want them to be. We want them to be moral examples. Nehemiah was. He had a capacity for moral indignation. Second, he had a compassion for the oppressed. He felt for these poor people. Out of his own funds, he had redeemed some, fed some, rescued some out of their bondage. He was a man of compassion for the poor and needy. Not many of the world's leaders have been. I read yesterday a shocking editorial about Mao Zedong, who recently died and was eulogized by the world's leaders, and yet he is a man who was responsible for the massacre of from 34 to 62 millions of people. I don't think he's a man who should be eulogized. He was a man who had no compassion. Nehemiah had a compassion for the poor and needy. Third place, he had a concern for justice. He wanted justice carried out, and he saw to it that it was. Chapter 5 demonstrates that. Fourth place, he had courage to denounce evil, even when wealthy, influential, and powerful men were involved. And that's not easy. I can well imagine that some of the leaders in Jerusalem, the substantial people who were making great donations toward the work of rebuilding the walls, were involved in this scandal. He didn't brush it under the rug for that reason. He brought it out into the open in a public rebuke. He had courage to deal with the problem even when powerful men, wealthy men, were involved in it. Again, I see from this chapter that he was a man who had a consistent walk. And he outlines that for us. Not that he's glorying in it, but he's demonstrating that he was a man of integrity. And finally, he had a consciousness that he was laboring not for the approval of man, but for the approval of God. Quite a chapter for what it demonstrates about the character of this man, Nehemiah. Great leader that he was. All right, must go on to chapter 6. Four more obstacles to the work of God. The fifth one, by deceit or craft. The problem, now it came to pass when Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem the Arabian and the rest of our enemies heard that I had builded the wall and that there was no breach left therein, though at the time I had not set up the doors in the gates. But Sanballat and Geshem sent unto me, saying, come, let us meet together in some one of the villages in the plain of Ono, 20 miles north of Jerusalem. Let us meet together in the plain of Ono. Let's forget our differences. Let's have a dialogue. Let's have an ecumenical meeting in the plain of Ono. And Nehemiah said, oh no. (Laughter) But they thought to do me mischief. They thought to do me mischief. You know, Sir William Tyndale, the great early translators of the Bible, fled England, was living with an English family in Antwerp, Belgium. And one day a friend invited him to lunch, a friend, quotation marks, invited him to lunch. William Tyndale did not know that this supposed friend had made contact with agents of British ecclesiastics who hated Tyndale. But he was seized as he was eating his lunch. He was thrown into a dungeon. And a few months later, he was dragged out into the courtyard where he was strangled and burned to death. Well, he should have said, like Nehemiah, oh no. The remedy? Verses 3 and 4. And I sent messengers unto them, saying, I am doing a great work so that I cannot come down. Why should the work cease while I leave it and come down to you? Yet they sent it to me four times after this sort, and I answered them after the same manner. Nehemiah says, my presence is needed here to supervise the work. Furthermore, and this is the principle involved here, the Lord's work is vital, it is important. It's not something to be taken up and put down at will. I am amazed at some people, how glibly they treat their spiritual responsibilities. Nehemiah says, you know, the Lord's work has priority in my life. It's not something to be taken up and put down just for every whim. My presence is needed here. I don't have time to come and talk with you. So they sent the messenger to him four times. And four times he sent back the same word. But you know, even that is a trick of the devil. You can say no once, and the second time comes, you say no. Third time, no, but I'll think about it, you know. And then before you know it, you're changing your mind. This is what happened to Balaam. The first time the messengers came to him, he said, won't go. Second time, he went. Samson and Delilah, remember, she finally got to him after pouting and crying a little bit, and three times asking him the secret of his strength. And finally, he gave her the answer. It's a trick of the devil. Watch out. So Nehemiah said, no, I'm engaged in God's work. My presence is needed here. I will not go. He said it four times. When God makes His will known to us, God doesn't change His mind. We need to be as firm and resolute as Nehemiah was. So he dealt with their deceit, their craftiness. Now, their intimidation in verses 5 through 9. The problem? Then sent Sanballat his servant unto me in like manner the fifth time, with an open letter in his hand, wherein was written, it's reported among the nations, and Gashmu saith it, and I guess that settled it. It's reported among the nations, Nehemiah, it's all over town, all over the community, that you and the Jews think to rebel. For which cause you build the wall, that thou mayest be their king, according to these words. Thou hast also appointed prophets to preach of thee at Jerusalem, saying, there is a king in Judah. Now shall it be reported to the king, according to these words, the king in Persia. That's a threat. Come now, therefore, and let us take counsel together. You get the veiled threat, the attempted intimidation of Nehemiah.
You're trying to rebel. You're going to foment a rebellion among the Jews. You're going to be made king. There are prophets that are preaching about this in Jerusalem, and we're going to send this word to the king of Persia, Artaxerxes Longimanus. Now, therefore, come on, let's sit down and talk about it. Then I sent unto them, here's the remedy. Then I sent unto them, saying, there are no such things done as thou sayest. But thou feignest, you imagine them out of your own heart. For they all made us afraid, saying their hands should be weakened from the work, that it be not done. Now therefore, O God, protect my reputation. No. Now therefore, O God, strengthen my hands. This open letter business, this gossip that was circulating, it's all over the community that you're planning to rebel. Maybe it was. Maybe they were circulating this false, malicious rumor among the Samaritans and the others. And Nehemiah flatly denies it. Interesting, and I think instructive here, as to how he handles gossip. Two ladies were talking. One lady said, well, you know, my dear, you can't believe everything you hear. She said, I understand that, but you can repeat it. Well, I don't think ladies are any worse than men on that score, probably. But how did Nehemiah handle gossip? How did he handle a rumor? Well, sometimes you can ignore gossip into silence. Just be impervious to it and let it go away. But sometimes you should deal with it decisively, and that's the way he did here. He flatly denied it. He said, it's imagination. You're imagining this, and then he committed it to God. He didn't send a letter of denial with 15 carbon copies all over the kingdom. It's not the way he handled it. He denied it, committed it to the Lord. Seventh method. Seventh obstacle, distraction, verses 10 to 14, distraction. The problem, afterward I came unto the house of Shemaiah, the son of Deliah, the son of Mehetabiel, who was confined. He was a man who was confined in his house. Either he was sick, either he was pretending to shut himself up in the house because he feared assassination, some suggest. And he said to Nehemiah, probably, or quietly, let's meet together in the house of God within the temple. Let's shut the doors of the temple, for they will come to slay thee. Yea, in the middle of the night they will come to slay thee. They're after you and they're after me. The guy was psychotic, I guess, or neurotic or something, or whatever. Somebody's after me, and they're after you. We better go to the temple and shut the doors of the temple, and there we'll have refuge. It was a trick. The remedy? Verse 11. And I said, should such a man as I flee? And who is there that being as I am would go into the temple to save his life? I will not go in. And lo, I perceived that God had not sent him, but that he pronounced this prophecy against me, for Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. Why, if they could get Nehemiah to run to the temple, shut the doors, secure himself there, that would send a ripple of fear through all of the people if the leader conducted himself in this manner. Therefore was he hired that I should be afraid and do so and sin, and that they might have matter for an evil report, that they might reproach me. My God, think thou upon Tobiah and Sanballat according to these their works, and on the prophetess Noadiah and on the rest of the prophets that would have put me in fear? So the wall was finished in the 25th day of the month Elul in 52 days. To me, this is a remarkable verse, and the first word is the most remarkable. If I had been writing this, I would have said, not so. But nevertheless, the wall was finished, or In spite of all of these problems, the wall was finished. But the wall was finished. All of these obstacles, but they carried on the work. But that isn't what it says. It's the little word so. As if the obstacles themselves enabled them to do the job. Remarkable little verse. There's a little sign in my son's room, John's room. That's the only boy we have at home now. He's the one that plays football. Tell you about that. And his little sign, he wrote it out in pencil. I don't know where he picked it up. Quitters never win, and winners never quit. When he was just a little guy, and he's now almost 6 foot, but he was about third or fourth grade, I think, he decided he wanted to play football. Well, it was a Y team, and in order to play, we had to join the Y, so that was $25. I said, okay, Jonathan, $25 on the line so you can play football. Well, about the second practice, the coach said a cross word to him, and he collapsed in a heap. And that was the end of football for John that season. There was no way we could get him to go back, you know. You know, you don't get out a whip and whip your boy down the street to the YMCA to play football. You just don't do that. So there's $25 down the drain. He didn't go to the YMCA all year. But he learned something. Because all that year he wanted to play football and he knew that he'd been a quitter. Well, somebody was asking me how he did. He did very well last Friday night. He caught four passes. They only threw two at him and he caught four. Intercepted two bombs in the fourth quarter, saved the game. So help me. Quitters never win, winners never quit. So the wall was finished. Fantastic. All right, the eighth obstacle, treachery. Boy, the walls are up, and the enemy still doesn't stop. And it came to pass when all our enemies heard thereof, and all the heathen at Rabbatus saw these things, they were much cast down in their eyes. They perceived this work was wrought of God, our God. Nehemiah didn't claim that he did the work. It was God's work. Moreover, in those days, the nobles of Judah sent letters unto Tobiah, the enemy, and letters of Tobiah came unto them. Think of it. Traitors within the camp. For there were many in Judah sworn unto him, an enemy, because he was son-in-law of Shechaniah, the son of Aaron. He had married a Jewish wife, and his son had taken the daughter of Meshullam, the son of Berechiah. There was intermarriage with the heathen. Also, they reported his good deeds before me and uttered my words to him, and Tobias sent me letters to put me in fear. One writer has said, stoutest walls will not protect against treason within the ramparts. Nehemiah had to learn that even with the walls up, he had to trust God. And he did. Daniel 11:32. I would write over this section of chapters. The people that do know their God shall be strong and shall do exploits. And here was a people that knew God under a leader who knew God, who walked with God, and they did exploits. For 90-some years, the people had said, it can't be done. Nehemiah came, and with the people who had a mind to work and who wouldn't quit, they finished the job. Thank you, Father, for this inspiring example of overcoming obstacles in the work of God. Lord, your work is never easy because the devil is always active. Paul said, we are not ignorant of his devices. So, Lord, help us to be alert to them and to know the remedies for Jesus' sake. Amen.